You're listening to This Rhetorical Life, a podcast dedicated to the practice, pedagogy, and public circulation of rhetoric in our lives. Last fall, Krista Ratcliffe came to Syracuse as the final keynote in our Rhetorical Listening and Composition Colloquium and Workshop series. Ratcliffe's presentation titled, Rhetorical Listening, What's Next?, revisited ideas from her 2005 book and discussed how other scholars have employed rhetorical listening to discuss educational policy, feminist methodology, and critical race studies. Ben Kiebrick and Carrie Ann Soto had a chance to sit down and chat with her about some of the themes in her presentation. Drawing on examples from the classroom and current issues, Ratcliffe offers insights on creating civic discourse, defining cultural logics, and enacting rhetorical listening in our composition pedagogies.
So thank you so much for coming on the show.
You are welcome.
So on the program, we've been exploring like the various links between people's daily lives and their experiences and rhetoric. And in the introduction of rhetorical listening, you set out a few of these experiences that led you to this study of gender and whiteness in relation to rhetorical listening and trying to get at this cross-cultural dialogue. So I was wondering if you could detail a couple of those experiences that led you to this sort of study.
Certainly. I think probably teaching more than anything. There was a moment in a rhetorical theory class that I regularly teach for juniors and seniors, and a young man was responding to the Cornel West book, Race Matters. And the young man was kind of twisting in his seat, you know, and then finally put up his hand, and I called on him, and he said, I think he's just exaggerating a little bit. He said, I don't wake up every morning, look in the mirror, and say, hey, I'm a white guy. He said, I just don't. I don't even think about it. And I looked at the young man and I said, well, don't you think maybe that's Cornel West's point? And then the room kind of erupted and there was a pretty good discussion. But what I realized later was that young man or anyone who agreed with him left the room further convinced that this was a liberal conspiracy and that he had no place to talk and that there wasn't really a conversation to be had on this topic. And so I stopped to think about why did I react the way I did, and why did he react the way he did, and what might be better? And, you know, reflecting on that, I realized that if I had stepped back and said something like, well, now that's a really interesting response. Let's think about that for a minute. People who might have that response, and notice I've immediately moved from him to people, what might be the way of reasoning that would lead them to that conclusion, you know? And we could have mapped out some very rough cultural logic on the board behind me, and then I could have said something like, well, if for people that might not agree with that but might take another stance, what might be a way of reasoning? And suddenly, I've got two discourses behind me that are both existing in our culture, and I could ask, what are the stakes for each one of these, you know, and for whom do the stakes exist? And suddenly you're doing a critique of discourse, you're doing an intellectual activity, you're not doing a naive reader response, you're wrong,
right.
Because you have this, quote, opinion. And you're also exposing that that's just my opinion response is, in a sense, a cop-out because a lot of people agree on the same things, and so there's a larger cultural logic that one is participating in when one usually says, this is my opinion, right? So it was those kind of moments in the classroom where I felt that I wasn't effectively opening one's mind. My goal was not to change the young man's mind, but I wanted him to open it up and at least entertain other possibilities. And if he comes around and he concludes that he still thinks Cornel West is exaggerating too much, okay, but at least it's more of an informed opinion and he has an awareness of what assumptions and what kind of reasoning pattern he's using to get there. I don't like it maybe, but you know, it's okay. Reasonable people can disagree. That's the first principle of rhetoric. That, I thought, would be way more effective pedagogy, and frankly, a way of modeling of being in the world once they're out of the classroom. You can transfer that into business. You can transfer that into, you know, social justice work. You can transfer it into lots of arenas.
Right. So instead of, like, the student has a conclusion that they bring up, and then the teacher may be countering with, well, this is another conclusion.
Right.
And sort of really taking the time to work towards the assumptions that
right.
underlie the
Right, right.
The perspective or like the point that one would make.
Right. When I talk about cultural logics, what I mean by that is, okay, if you assume certain things, then you decide to think in a certain way, and that gives you a cultural script for acting in a certain way. So we're back to Kenneth Burke's notion of rhetoric with its socializing function having both a means of moving one to attitude and to action. And so thinking about cultural logics that way, what's the assumption? What's kind of the principle that I'm functioning from, and then what kind of action gets associated with that? And suddenly people see that, yes, I believe this, but I'm not alone, and it not just helps them see cultural logics, but it helps them see it as something that can be critiqued and analyzed with a non-personal threat attached to it. And I think that's key. I know some critical pedagogy is very big on making students feel uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And while I respect that with people who can do it well, my personality is such that I can't do that well because I get more uncomfortable than the student, and then it's just, no, it doesn't work for me. So this worked better.
Yeah, and I believe it's your first chapter where you're defining rhetorical listening. I was drawn to the example of listening to a student's listening. Mm-hmm. And so I was wondering if you could summarize that for our listeners or provide us with another example in which you've seen that the students are engaging in rhetorical listening.
Right.
Perhaps outside of the classroom, maybe inside of the classroom, they're like overtly aware of it.
Right. Yeah, that was an important pedagogical moment for me. It was a real learning experience because I was giving a talk at UWM, and I was trying to write this up a little bit, and I was teaching a women's literature course at the same time, and we were reading Beloved, and this young woman was a criminal justice major and an English major, I believe, combined, or maybe political science and English major combined. But anyway, she had gone to a talk. Someone who worked in the prison systems in Wisconsin was talking about the prisoners and defining them and how they behaved and what their problems were, what their issues were, what their talents were. But he referred to them as chained dogs. He said, how do you expect people to react if you know chain them like dogs? And he kept referring to them as dogs. And we had been talking about Beloved, the chapter where the only one told from the white people's point of view in Beloved, and it's from the four horsemen show up, right? The four horsemen of the apocalypse from the Bible, but it's the four horsemen that come to get Sethi and her family. And in there, the white farm owner talks about how you can't beat animals like you would beat a horse because you render them unusable. And so it's not that you don't beat slaves because they're human beings, you don't beat them because they're animals. And so suddenly, that morning she had heard prisoners compared to chained dogs, and she'd heard the sort of slave logic that justifies having slaves but treating them in a certain way. And laying those two things side by side for her was a real eureka moment in terms of the cultural logic of what it means to be human and what our classifications of humans are and how that justifies certain behaviors and actions with and against other people. And she wrote a wonderful, beautiful paper that practically made me weep. And it was like, wow, all these things I've been thinking, I just kind of see. Now, part of it was I was impressing on her, you know, what my framework was, but she was also informing me. It was just a nice dialogic moment in the classroom. And I had to later ask her for permission to use her paper in the book, and she was like, oh, I'm sort of horrified that this is going to be out there. And she said, but I guess it's okay. I understand what you're trying to do here. So, yeah.
Great.
One of the concepts that I was most interested in, or one of the parts of rhetorical listening, was the concept of accountability. Mm-hmm. And you had on one side erasing differences to try to identify,
right.
And then on the other side you have erasing commonality so that you can name all of the differences in access and privilege. So accountability seemed to be the term that found a space that could acknowledge both sides, right? So I was just curious if you, how did you come to that term accountability? What does it mean in practice? Or if there's examples that come to mind?
Yeah, it was precisely that. I mean, because in the academy we had focused so long on, you know, identification as commonality where necessary differences are bridged in terms of rhetoric. And that is true, but it also has a set of problems that hadn't been necessarily addressed. And then with the multicultural, all the postmodern, post-structuralists, we had all this focus on difference, which kind of denied the commonality. And so it's a both and, you know, there's always commonality and difference. and sometimes neither. You know, it's just you're kind of up against one another. And so I was trying to think about how listening with that in mind might be a possibility. So accountability as a stance of listening. I talk particularly about moving from a dysfunctional silence where the stance is largely, I'm not guilty, I didn't do anything, or, you know, don't blame me, to a rhetorical listening stance of accountability where, okay, I didn't do anything, don't blame me, but I was born into a system that pre-existed me because of how I'm classified, whether it's in terms of health or race or citizenship or whatever. I have certain privileges that I circle in and out of. And to what extent am I accountable for how that privileges me and does not privilege others? And if privilege is not a thing that you're born into and it's there forever. It changes and, you know, as I say, you cycle in and out of them. Initially, in the article in 3Cs, I had used responsibility. And when I did the book, I changed it to accountability. And I thought that was an important distinction. Joyce Middleton and I have gone back and forth. She likes responsibility better. But responsibility resonated for me. I could hear echoes of responsible. And I didn't really want people taking a stance of feeling responsible for racism, because we were all born into a system where that pre-existed all of us. But to what extent are we accountable for the now? And free of guilt and blame, because guilt and blame is basically narcissistic.
Right.
You know, I blame myself, I feel guilty, or I'm not guilty, somebody else wants to blame, you know, that's still right. All about me, 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 me. Rhetorical listening asks us to look outward, I think.
So we're accountable for now, but also accountable for, like, the histories that inform...
Well, we're accountable for what we do now in the present, recognizing that the moment we are in now is shaped and created by the past. It's not a denial of the past. It's not taking responsibility for the past in terms of causing. It's taking responsibility and, well, preferably accountability for how we behave given the structure we find ourselves in. Yeah.
So I wanted to go back to the talk yesterday in which you mentioned being interested in looking at civic discourse.
Mm-hmm.
And especially when one side is not so civil.
Yes.
So could you remind us of some of the strategies that one can employ to deal with those who refuse to listen and insist on being uncivil?
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things I've found slightly amusing about people's reception of rhetorical listening is they think it solves a problem. They think that if you listen rhetorically, then boom, everything will be fine, you know? And I keep saying, no, it's a tactic in the same way that analyzing the enthymeme is a tactic, you know? That doesn't solve the world. Rhetorical listening doesn't solve the world. So it's a critical analytical move that's a little different from some other interpretive moves. But so with that in mind, when you've got, I think what came up in the talk yesterday was what happens when you've got, say, abortion protesters and someone is shoving either a bottled fetus in your face or a picture or some doll representation. What do you do? How do you make that person civil and have a conversation with that person? And my response was, you might not be able to. You know, the enthymeme doesn't always work. Rhetorical listening doesn't always work. So I'm not out here making promises for a kumbaya world. But that said, part of what you do is figure out, okay, who's the audience that will listen? Who's the rhetorical audience in Bitzer's terms who has the power to make changes? Those sorts of things, if you listen to think about which logic will I approach the person on, then I think you can kind of make a difference. So rhetorical listening is helpful, I think, in terms of thinking through those kind of things. But it doesn't solve all problems, and I don't pretend that it will.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I also think I could also then say, okay, I don't agree with somebody politically. They're just stupid. They believe that. Well, maybe not. Maybe they actually have a set of assumptions and a way of reasoning and logically come to the conclusion that they want a certain bill passed. I may disagree with them vehemently, but I can also recognize they're smart, they're committed, they're ethical. And rather than just dismissing somebody as stupid, having the ground of respect is kind of important. So I think that's the other way in which it can help.
So is it safe to say that rhetorical listening is a tactic that can be used once they're in these situations, like you mentioned the classroom, or maybe in when someone's lobbying and has mm-hmm. the access to mm-hmm. a politician that has mm-hmm. the ability to make the change. It's a tactic for those moments where there is a difference of opinion, mm-hmm. but at least the ability to speak and hear each other. Mm-hmm. Like, is that kind of safe to say, and try to map some of these, like, the conditions in which rhetorical mm-hmm. listening seems useful? And
yeah, yes, I think that's a fair statement. I also think, for example, I remember someone, one of my daughter's friend's mother saying to me right after 9/11, I don't care how these terrorists think, we just ought to bomb them all, you know? Mm-hmm. And I get how that she reached that conclusion. But it struck me at the time, I thought, unless we know how people think, we're never going to be able to intervene. So I chose at that moment not to engage that. So, you know, I listened rhetorically, but I then didn't act with her on that. I've obviously thought about it a lot since, but one could, I suppose. So the condition, it's hard to generalize. You kind of, it depends. If it were something if where I thought, this is important enough that I have to try, mm-hmm. I would. So
right.
It's kind of hard to say, is there a set of conditions that always works and always not?
Yeah. But one thing that example does for me mm-hmm. makes me think, like, rhetorical listening is a tactic not for just, like, immediate action.
Right.
I want to persuade someone right now.
Exactly.
But I've got a chance to learn some
right.
of their perspective so that I can be better at
yes.
persuading someone in the future.
Exactly.
Or having to hear my point of view later.
Right. Right.
And that not every moment is a moment where I'm also
right.
speaking.
Right.
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 Okay.
Yeah.
Is
yeah.
that also a part of the strategic idealism
mm-hmm.
that you were
yes.
mentioning in your book? So
yes.
Could you just give us a little bit of a description of how that relates in terms of, is it kind of like a micro approach to idealism?
I suppose it is, in a sense. Certain terms take on negative connotations in the academy, right? And so, for example, within feminist studies, essentialism took on this very negative term, and I believe it was Spivak who came out and said, strategic essentialism, sometimes you have to create a coalition, common ground, present a united front, and know we're not all alike, but we're going to pretend we are for political action. And one of the charges against rhetorical listening when I first started talking about this was people say, well, it doesn't always work. And I was like, I know. You know, neither do thesis statements. But I've been fascinated. I probably have to write about this sometime, but I don't have it enough in my head yet. Why does idealism get so linked to listening? And I think there's a long history of listening in religion, and there's a long history of listening in managerial handbooks. There's a long history of listening in philosophy and in communication studies, for example. So they're different elements, but for most people on the street, they think you're just born to listen. You know, you grow up, you talk, you listen, you know. You learn to read, you learn to write, and you kind of learn to talk, but you just listen. And so it's this natural thing that just is, and so you don't need to be taught and constructed as this ideal bodily function of some way. And then there's this notion added onto that that if I listen to you, I'm showing respect, right? Because it's always been kind of a reception strategy, so I'm choosing to respect you, or I'm listening for God or something for greater instruction. And so there's this passive reception respect that's attached to it, and it's like the higher truth is going to come to you. So I wanted to counter that a little bit, but you never get away from that. And I think those two factors, the sort of, you know, it's this ideal bodily function, but it's also this which we hear something outside ourselves, we know something greater than ourselves through listening, idealize how we think about it. So, oh, if you listen to me, oh, you know, in some ways it's our greatest desire for somebody else to actually hear us and know us and who we are. So the idealism it was slightly annoying in the sense that people couldn't hear listening as a trope. When I would say it's a trope of interpretive invention, reading is a trope. There is a thing, a physical, material practice of reading, but reading, our EADING, is a trope we use to talk about some of those practices. Listening is a trope, and when I talk about rhetorical listening, it's a trope for a way of positioning yourself with a text. it wasn't this ideal God in my ear kind of thing, but people immediately went there and wanted it to be something that solved all problems. Mm-hmm. And I guess I was surprised by that, and as I said, slightly annoyed, but then I decided, it's really, why be annoyed? It's kind of interesting. Let's figure out why this is going on. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's a very long-winded answer to your question, but what was happening is they were, like, conflating idealism with this listening, and I'm just saying it's a rhetorical tactic, and that's pragmatic. That's in the real, in the moment, and it's hard for people to give up that idealism. So I decided, well, let's talk about it in terms of strategic idealism, and then that made more sense. So.
Right. Yeah. Is that maybe a part of listening hadn't been part of discussions of rhetoric for a long time?
Right. It had been in communications, but it hadn't been in comp and English studies.
Right.
And philosophy has a long history of talking about listening in the Logos, and obviously it was Heidegger I went to get some of the sort of theoretical touchstone to build on.
Right. Thank you so much for spending time with us.
Yeah. Yeah.
This Rhetorical Life is brought to you by graduate students in the Composition and Cultural Rhetoric program at Syracuse University. Executive producers of This Rhetorical Life are Ben Kiebrick and Allison Hitt, with additional production and editing from Carrie Ann Soto, Tamara Isak, and Jana Rosinski.